your tongue. Do it a long time, baby, till you make me. Quarters boss, high sheriff, let me get gone from here. Cold rainy day, some old cold rainy day. I'll be back some old cold rainy day. Oh, the rocks may be my pillow, Lord. The sand may be my bed. I'll be back some old cold rainy day. Who run? What you running from the man for, nigga? Me? I don't aim to run a step. I ain't going to run unless they run me. That white man come messing with me and I'll cut him a brand new butthole. I'm going to live anyhow till I die. Play me some music so I can dance. I'll spank that box, man. Them white folks don't care nothing about no nigga getting cut and killed nohow. They ain't coming in here. I done killed me four and they ain't hung me yet. Beat that box. Yeah, but you ain't killed no women yet. They's mighty particular about you killing up women. And I ain't killing none neither. I ain't crazy in the head. Nigga woman can kill all us men she wants to and they don't care. Leave us kill a woman and they'll run you just as long as you can find something to step on. I got good sense. I know I ain't got no show. The white men's and the nigger women is running this thing. Sing about old Georgia Buck and let's dance off of it. Hit that box! Old Georgia Buck is dead. Last word he said, I don't want no shortening in my bread. Rabbit on the log, ain't got no dog. Shoot him with my rifle, bam, bam. And the night. The pay night rocks on with music and gambling and laughter and dancing and fights. The big pile of cross ties burning out in front simmers down to low ashes before sunup. So then it is time to throw up all the liquor you can't keep down and go somewhere and sleep the rest off, whether your knife has blood on it or not. That is, unless some strange, low member of your own race has gone and pumped to the white folks about something getting hurt. Very few of those kind are to be found. That is the primeval flavor of the place, and as I said before, out of this primitive approach to things, I all but lost my life. It was in a sawmill juke in Polk County that I almost got cut to death. Lucy really wanted to kill me. I didn't mean any harm. All I was doing was collecting songs from Slim, who used to be her man back up in West Florida before he ran off from her. It is true that she found out where he was after nearly a year and followed him to Polk County, and he paid her some slight attention. He was knocking the pad with women all around, and he seemed to want a sort of freelance at it. But what he seemed to care most about was picking his guitar and singing. He was a valuable source of material to me, so I built him up a bit by buying him drinks and letting him ride in my car. I figured that Lucy took a pick at me for three reasons. The first one was, her vanity was rubbed sore at not being able to hold her man. That was hard to own up to in a community where so much stress was laid on suiting. Nobody else had offered to shack up with her either. She was getting a very limited retail trade, and Slim was ignoring the whole business. I had store-bought clothes, a lighter skin, and a shiny car, so she saw wherein she could use me for an alibi. So in spite of public knowledge of the situation for a year or more before I came, she was telling it around that I came and broke them up. She was going to cut everything off of me, but quit it. Her second reason was, because of my research methods, I had dug in with the male community. Most of the women liked me, too, especially her sworn enemy, Big Sweet. She was scared of Big Sweet, but she probably reasoned that if she cut Big Sweet's protege, it would be a slam on Big Sweet and build up her own reputation. She was fighting Big Sweet through me. Her third reason was, she had been in little scraps and been to jail off and on, but she could not swear that she had ever killed anybody. She was small potatoes, and nobody was paying her any mind. I was easy. I had no gun, knife, or any sort of weapon. I did not even know how to do that kind of fighting. Lucky for me, I had friended with Big Sweet, She came to my notice within the first week that I arrived on location. I heard somebody, a woman's voice, specifying up this line of houses from where I lived and asked who it was. "That's Big Sweet," my landlady told me. "She got a foot up on somebody. Ain't she specifying?" She was really giving the particulars. She was giving a reading, a word borrowed from the fortune tellers. She was giving her opponent lurid data and bringing him up to date on his ancestry, his looks, smell, gait, clothes, and his route through hell in the hereafter. My landlady went outside where nearly everybody else of the 400 or 500 people on the job were to listen to the reading. Big Sweet broke the news to him in one of her mildest bulletins that his pa was a double-humped camel and his ma was a grass-gut cow. But even so, he tore her wide open in the act of getting born, and so on and so forth. He was a bitch's baby out of a buzzard egg. My landlady explained to me what was meant by putting your foot up on a person. If you are sufficiently armed, enough to stand off a panzer division, and know what to do with your weapons after you get 'em, it is all right to go to the house of your enemy, put one foot up on his steps, rest one elbow on your knee, and play in the family. That is another way of saying play the dozens, which is a way of saying low-rate your enemy's ancestors and him down to the present moment for reference, and then go into his future as far as your imagination leads you. But if you have no faith in your personal courage and confidence in your arsenal, don't try it. It is a risky pleasure. So then I had a measure of this Big Sweet. "Hurt who?" Mrs. Bertha snorted at my fears. "Big Sweet? Hmm. 'Tain't a man, woman, nor child on this job going to tackle Big Sweet. If God send her a pistol, she'll send him a man. She can handle a knife with anybody. She'll join hands and cut a duel. That cracker quarters boss wears two pistols round his waist and goes for bad, but he won't break a breath with Big Sweet, lessen he got his pistol in his hand. 'Cause if he start anything with her, he won't never get a chance to draw it. She done killed two men's on this job, and they said she killed some before she ever come here. She ain't mean. She don't bother nobody. She just don't stand for no foolishness, that's all." Right away, I decided that Big Sweet was going to be my friend. From what I had seen and heard in the short time I had been there, I felt as timid as an egg without a shell. So the next afternoon when she was pointed out to me, I waited until she was well up the sawdust road to the commissary. Then I got in my car and went that way as if by accident. When I pulled up beside her and offered her a ride, she frowned at me first, then looked puzzled, but finally broke into a smile and got in. By the time we got to the commissary post office, we were getting along fine. She told everybody I was her friend. We did not go back to the quarters at once. She carried me around to several places and showed me off. We made a date to go down to Lakeland come Saturday, which we did. By the time we sighted the quarters on the way back from Lakeland, she had told me, "You sure is crazy," which is a way of saying I was witty. "I loves to friend with somebody like you. I aims to look out for you, too. Do your fighting for you. Nobody better not start nothing with you. Do I'll get my switchblade and go round the ham bone looking for me." We shook hands, and I gave her one of my bracelets. After that, everything went well for me. Big Sweet helped me to collect material in a big way. She had no idea what I wanted with it, but if I wanted it, she meant to see to it that I got it. She pointed out people who knew songs and stories. She wouldn't stand for balkiness on their part. We held two lying contests, storytelling contests, to you, and Big Sweet passed on who rated the prizes. In that way, there was no arguments about it. So when the word came to Big Sweet that Lucy was threatening me, she put her foot up on Lucy in a most particular manner and warned her against the try. I suggested buying a knife for defense, but she said I would certainly be killed that way. "You don't know how to handle no knife. You ain't got that kind of sense. You wouldn't even know how to hold it to the best advantage. You would draw your arm way back to stop her, and whilst you was doing all that, Lucy would run in under your arm and be done cut you to death before you could touch her. And then again, when you sure enough fighting, it ain't enough to just stick 'em with your knife. You got to ram it in to the hilt, and then you pull down. They ain't no more trouble after that. They's dead. But don't you bother about no fighting. You ain't like me. You don't even sleep with no men's. I wanted to be a virgin one time, but I couldn't keep it up. I needed the money too bad. But I think it's nice for you to be like that. You just keep on writing down them lies. I'll take care of all the fighting. That'll make it more better since we done made friends. She warned me that Lucy might try to steal me, that is, ambush me, or otherwise attack me without warning. So I was careful. I went nowhere on foot without Big Sweet. Several weeks went by, then I ventured to the Juke alone. Big Sweet let it be known that she was not going. But later she came in and went over to the coon can game in the corner. Thinking I was alone, Lucy waited until things were in full swing, and then came in with the very man to whom Big Sweet had given the reading. There was only one door. I was far from it. I saw no escape for me when Lucy strode in, knife in hand. I saw sudden death very near that moment. I was paralyzed with fear. Big Sweet was in a crowd over in the corner and did not see Lucy come in. But the sudden quiet of the place made her look around as Lucy charged. My friend was large and portly, but extremely light on her feet. She sprang like a lioness, and I think the very surprise of Big Sweet being there when Lucy thought she was over to another party at the pine mill unnerved Lucy. She stopped abruptly as Big Sweet charged. The next moment it was too late for Lucy to start again. The man who came in with Lucy tried to help her out, but two other men joined Big Sweet in the battle. It took on amazingly. It seemed that anybody who had any fighting to do decided to settle up then and there. Switchblades, ice picks, and old-fashioned razors were out. One or two razors had already been bent back and thrown across the room, but our fight was the main attraction. Big Sweet yelled to me to run. I really ran, too. I ran out of the place, ran to my room, threw my things in the car, and left the place. When the sun came up, I was 100 miles up the road, headed for New Orleans. In New Orleans, I delved into hoodoo, or sympathetic magic. I studied with the Frizzly Rooster and all of the other noted doctors. I learned the routines for making and breaking marriages, driving off and punishing enemies, influencing the minds of judges and juries in favor of clients, killing by remote control, and other things. In order to work with these two-headed doctors, I had to go through an initiation with each. The routine varied with each doctor. In one case, it was not only elaborate, it was impressive. I lay naked for 3 days and nights on a couch, with my navel to a rattlesnake skin which had been dressed and dedicated to the ceremony. I ate no food in all that time. Only a pitcher of water was on a little table at the head of the couch so that my soul would not wander off in search of water and be attacked by evil influences and not return to me. On the second day, I began to dream strange, exalted dreams. On the third night, I had dreams that seemed real for weeks. In one, I strode across the heavens with lightning flashing from under my feet and grumbling thunder following in my wake. In this particular ceremony, my finger was cut and I became blood brother to the rattlesnake. We were to aid each other forever. I was to walk with the storm and hold my power and get my answers to life and things in storms. The symbol of lightning was painted on my back. This was to be mine forever. In another ceremony, I had to sit at the crossroads at midnight in complete darkness and meet the devil and make a compact. That was a long, long hour, as I sat flat on the ground there alone and invited the king of hell. The most terrifying was going to a lonely glade in the swamp to get the black cat bone. The magic circle was made, and all of the participants were inside. I was told that anything outside that circle was in deadly peril. The fire was built inside, the pot prepared, and the black cat was thrown in with the proper ceremony and boiled until his bones fell apart. Strange and terrible monsters seemed to thunder up to that ring while this was going on. It took months for me to doubt it afterwards. When I left Louisiana, I went to South Florida again, and from what I heard around Miami, I decided to go to the Bahamas. I had heard some Bahamian music and seen a jumping dance out in Liberty City, and I was entranced. This music of the Bahamian Negroes was more original, dynamic, and African than American Negro songs. I just had to know more. So without giving Godmother a chance to object, I sailed for Nassau. I loved the place the moment I landed. Then, that first night, as I lay in bed, listening to the rustle of a coconut palm just outside my window, a song accompanied by string and drum broke out in full harmony. I got up and peeped out and saw four young men, and they were singing Bellamina, led by Ned Isaacs. I did not know him then, but I met him the next day. The song has a beautiful air and the oddest rhythm. Bellamina, Bellamina, she come back in the harbor. Bellamina, Bellamina, she come back in the harbor. Put Bellamina on the dock and paint Bellamina black, black. Oh, put Bellamina on the dock and paint Bellamina black, black. I found out later that it was a song about a rum-running boat that had been gleaming white, but after it had been captured by the United States Coast Guard and released, it was painted black, for obvious reasons. That was my welcome to Nassau, and it was a beautiful one. The next day I got the idea of what prolific songmakers the Bahamans are. With that West African accent grafted on English of the uneducated Bahaman, I was told, "You do anything, we put you in sing." I walked carefully to keep out of sing. This visit to Nassau was to have far-reaching effects. I stayed on, ran to every jumping dance that I heard of, learned to jump, collected more than 100 tunes, and resolved to make them known to the world. On my return to New York in 1932, after trying vainly to interest others, I introduced Bahaman songs and dances to a New York audience at the John Golden Theater, and both the songs and the dances took on. The concert achieved its purpose. I aimed to show what beauty and appeal there was in genuine Negro material, as against the Broadway concept, and it went over. Since then, there has been a sharp trend towards genuine Negro material. The dances aroused a tremendous interest in primitive Negro dancing. Hall Johnson took my group to appear with his singers at the Lewison Stadium that summer and built his Run Lil' Chillin' around them and the religious scene from my concert, From Sun to Sun. That was not all. The dramatized presentation of Negro work songs in that same concert aroused interest in them, and they have been exploited by singers ever since. I had no intention of making concert my field. I wanted to show the wealth and beauty of the material to those who were in the field, and therefore I felt that my job was well done when it took on. My group was invited to perform at the New School of Social Research in the Folk Dance Carnival at the Vanderbilt Hotel in New York at NIAC, at St. Louis, Chicago, Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida, Lake Wales, Sanford, Orlando, Constitution Hall, Washington, D.C., and Daytona Beach, Florida. Besides the finding of the dances and the music, two other important things happened to me in Nassau. One was, I lived through that terrible 5-day hurricane of 1929. It was horrible in its intensity and duration. I saw dead people washing around on the streets when it was over. You could smell the stench from dead animals as well. More than 300 houses were blown down in the city of Nassau alone. Then I saw something else out there. I met Leon Walton Young. He is a grizzly, stocky black man who is a legislator in the House. He represented the first district in the Bahamas and had done so for more than 20 years when I met him. Leon Walton Young was either a great hero or a black bounder, according to who was doing the talking. He was a great champion and a hero in the mouths of the lowly blacks of the islands, and to a somewhat lesser degree to the native-born whites. He was a Bahaman for the Bahaman man, and a stout fellow along those lines. To the English who had been sent out to take the jobs of the natives, white and black, he was a cheeky dastard of a black colonial who needed to be put in his place. He was also too much for the mixed-blood Negroes of education and property who were as prejudiced against his color as the English. What was more, Leon Walton Young had no formal education, though I found him, like George Schuyler of New York, to be better read than most people with college degrees. But did he, because of his lack of schooling, defer to the Negroes who had journeyed to London and Edinburgh? He most certainly did not. And what was more, he more than held his own in the hustings. There was a much-felt need for him to be put down, but those who put on the white armor of St. George to go out and slay the dragon always came back, not honorably dead on their shields, but splattered all over with mud and the seat of their pants torn and missing. A peasant mounted on a mule had unhorsed a cavalier and took his pants. The dance drums of Grantstown and Bainetown would throb, and his humbled opponents would be put in sing. He so humbled a governor, who tried to overawe Young by reminding him that he was His Majesty's representative in these islands, that the governor was recalled and sent to some peaceful spot in West Africa. Young had replied to that pompous statement with, "Yes, but if you continue your tactics out here, you will make me forget it." That was one of his gentlest thumps on the governor's pride and prestige. His Majesty's representative accused Young of having said publicly that he, the governor, was a bum out of the streets of London, and to his eternal rage. Young more than admitted the statement. The English appointees and the high yellows shuddered at such temerity, but the local whites and the working blacks gloried in his spunk. A most dramatic incident came out of this struggle of the local Bahamans against the policy of the British government of taking care of the surplus of unemployed at the expense of the islands. When I returned to Nassau for the fourth time in 1935, the elections for the House were on. A Negro barrister, who is not yellow but who liked to think he was, had thrown down the gauntlet to Young. He had informed the English that he would rid them of the troublesome Leon Walton Young. The young man, whom I shall call Botts, because that is not his name, got a pat on the back and was told to go ahead. As I said before, Young represented the first district, which was the richest in the islands. It is that end of the island of New Providence where the hotels, the homes of the wealthy foreigners, and the business and government houses are located. He had been re-elected for 3 terms of 7 years each. A local white businessman came to Young in secret and told him what was happening undercover. Young, on hearing the boasts of Botts, got busy in secret on his own. He took under his wing a young white barrister, only a year out of Lincoln's Inn, and primed him for a candidate. Botts was up for re-election, and the young white stripling was dressed to stand for Botts' district, which was in the Outer Islands. Secret messages went to the district in the Outer Islands, the political fence was looked over and put in order, and then Young launched his attack. He stood out in the middle of Bay Street, flung wide his arms like a cross, and cried out, "Send me a man to stand for the first district. I am going out to Eleuthera to stand, so that this Bots, this betrayer of his country and his people, can be driven out of office. Send me a man." Nobody sent him a man, as he well knew they would not. His re-election was taken for granted, but he stirred the Bahamas from end to end by his gesture. People remembered things about Barrister Botts they otherwise would have forgotten. Poor people down on the waterfront remembered that, though he went for a great man now. His mother had stood down on the waterfront night after night selling fried fish to send him to England to be educated. His father was living and prosperous. He was in business and a member of the house. But long years ago, he had divorced Botts's mother for a woman of lighter skin. But the mother had seen him through the inner temple. He had come back, not full of gratitude for the sacrifices she had made, but scornful of her black skin and all that she stood for. People said that he paid her 10 shillings, $2.50 a week, to stay away from his house. He was being accused of robbing his younger brother of funds, and legal action was underway at the very moment of the election. The election was to be on Sunday. On Friday, Botts went out in a chartered boat. He was dressed in the latest from London and quite the patrician. On the boat with him was the same white man who had given Young all the information. The man was to report on everything that went on, though Botts thought he was there out of gratitude and admiration. On Saturday, Leon Walton Young, his protege and his coterie of workers, boarded a big black boat to go out to Eleuthera. With them was Wilbur Botts, going out to campaign against his brother. They left the old woman, mother of both of the boys, on the dock. She was ragged, not too clean, and bitter. As the boat steamed out, she was muttering, "God, I wish I could go. I want to campaign against him, too." And she shook her clenched fists in the general direction of her barrister son's district. "God, I wish I could go." Before dawn on that Sunday morning, a big black boat with Leon Walton Young and his barrister protege dropped anchor in a harbor at Eleuthera. About 8 o'clock, Botts came on deck on his boat, dressed in faultless doeskin trousers, to take the air. Seeing the big black boat, which had not been there the night before, he lifted his glasses and studied the boat and the people on her deck. Suddenly, he lowered his glasses and turned to the white man Leon Young had placed at his elbow and asked, "Isn't that Young on that boat?" The man took the glasses and pretended to find out what he already knew. "Yes, that is Walton Young." Botts dropped heavily into a deck chair without regards to his creases. He was a sodden mess from then on through the election. They all landed and the fight was on. The protege of Young won without making a single speech. It was Young who dashed from place to place talking and rallying the people. By noon, Botts conceded the election to his opponent and returned to Nassau. I was down at the wharf when the boats returned. I wanted to see the behavior of the old woman who had been divorced by her husband for being too black after he gained a certain amount of success. The same woman who had been barred from her son's home for the same reason, after she had felt no labor was too humble for her to do, to put him through law school in London to come home to her a barrister. She was not there. I wondered if she was off somewhere trying to rustle up a tuppence or two, or merely that she did not want to look on his dear face when his pretensions had met his realities. She had her bitter moments, but after all, she was his mother. Monday night, the election was insane. Young's election came up a few days later, and as he well knew, he was returned to his seat. But not before he had engineered the defeat of Botts Sr. in another district. Then the drums of Bainetown really thundered. "Young, da-don-don-don, him a great dentist, don't don, him pull Botts out the house." and the common folk danced off the feet and were very glad. To them, life was not hopeless, as long as their champion was in the fight. The humble Negroes of America are great songmakers, but the Bahaman is greater. He is more prolific and his tunes are better. Nothing is too big or little to be put in sing. They only need discovery. They are much more original than the calypso singers of Trinidad, as will be found the moment you put it to the proof. I hear that now the Duke of Windsor is their great hero. To them, he is our king. I would love to hear how he and his duchess have been put in sing. I enjoyed collecting the folk tales, and I believe the people from whom I collected them enjoyed the telling of them, just as much as I did the hearing. Once they got started, the lies just rolled, and storytellers fought for a chance to talk. It was the same with the songs. The one thing to be guarded against, in the interest of truth, was over-enthusiasm. For instance, if a song was going good and the material ran out, the singer was apt to interpolate pieces of other songs into it. The only way you can know when that happens is to know your material so well that you can sense the violation. Even if you do not know the song that is being used for padding, you can tell the change in rhythm and tempo. The words do not count. The subject matter in Negro folk songs can be anything and go from love to work to travel, to food, to weather, to fight, to demanding the return of a wig by a woman who has turned unfaithful. The tune is the unity of the thing, and you have to know what you are doing when you begin to pass on that. Because Negroes can fit in more words and leave out more and still keep the tune than anyone I can think of. One bit of research I did jointly for the Journal of Negro History and Columbia University was in Mobile, Alabama. There I went to talk to Cujo Lewis. That is the American version of his name. His African name was Kosola Ololue. He arrived on the last load of slaves run into the United States and was the only Negro alive that came over on a slave ship. It happened in 1859. Just when the fight between the South and the abolitionists was moving toward the Civil War. He has died since I saw him. I found him a cheerful, poetical old gentleman in his late 90s who could tell a good story. His interpretation of the story of Jonah is marvelous. He was a good Christian, and so he pretended to have forgotten all of his African religion. He turned me off with the statement that his Nigerian religion was the same as Christianity. "We know it's a god, you understand, but we don't know he got a son." He told me in detail of the circumstances in Africa that brought about his slavery here. How the powerful kingdom of Dahomey, finding the slave trade so profitable, had abandoned farming, hunting, and all else to capture slaves to stock the barracoons on the beach at Dmida to sell to the slavers who came from across the ocean. How quarrels were manufactured by the king of Dahomey with more peaceful agricultural nations in striking distance of Dahomey in Nigeria and Gold Coast. How they were assaulted, completely wiped off the map, their names never to appear again, except when they were named in boastful chant before the king at one of his customs, when his glory was being sung. The able-bodied who were captured were marched to Abomey, the capital city of Dahomey, and displayed to the king, then put into the barracoons to await a buyer. The too old, the too young, the injured in battle, were instantly beheaded, and their heads smoked and carried back to the king. He paid off on heads, dead or alive. The skulls of the slaughtered were not wasted either. The king had his famous palace of skulls. The palace grounds had a massive gate of skull heads. The walls surrounding the grounds were built of skulls. You see, the kings of Dahomey were truly great and mighty, and a lot of skulls were bound to come out of their ambitions. While it looked awesome and splendid to him and his warriors, the sight must have been most gruesome and crude to Western eyes. Imagine a palace of Hindu or Zulu skulls in London, or Javanese skulls in The Hague. One thing impressed me strongly from this 3 months of association with Cujo Lewis. The white people had held my people in slavery here in America. They had bought us, it is true, and exploited us. But the inescapable fact that stuck in my craw was my people had sold me, and the white people had bought me. That did away with the folklore I had been brought up on, that the white people had gone to Africa, waved a red handkerchief at the Africans, and lured them aboard ship and sailed away. I know that civilized money stirred up African greed, that wars between tribes were often stirred up by white traders to provide more slaves in the barracoons and all that. But if the African princes had been as pure and as innocent as I would like to think, it could not have happened. No. My own people had butchered and killed, exterminated whole nations and torn families apart, for a profit before the strangers got their chance at a cut. It was a sobering thought. What is more, all that this Cujo told me was verified from other historical sources. It impressed upon me the universal nature of greed and glory. Lack of power and opportunity passes off too often for virtue. If I were king, let us say, over the Western Hemisphere tomorrow, instead of who I am, what would I consider right and just? Would I put the cloak of justice on my ambition and send her out a whoring after conquests? It is something to ponder over with fear. Cujo's eyes were full of tears and memory of fear when he told me of the assault on his city and its capture. He said that his nation, the Takoi, lived three sleeps from Dahomey. The attack came at dawn as the Takoi were getting out of bed to go to their fields outside the city. A whooping horde of the famed Dahomean women warriors burst through the main gate, seized people as they fled from their houses, and beheaded victims with one stroke of their big swords. Oh, I run it this way to that gate, but they there. I run it to another one, but they there too. All 8 gates, they there. Them women, they very strong. I'm 19 years old, but they too strong for me. They take me and tie me. I don't know where my people at. I never see them no more. He described the awful slaughter as the Amazons sacked the city. The clusters of human heads at their belts. The plight of those who fled through the gates to fall into the hands of the male warriors outside. How his king was finally captured and carried before the king of Dahomey, who had broken his rule and come on this expedition in person because of a grudge against the king of Takoi, and how the vanquished monarch was led before him, bound. "Now that you have dared to send impudent words to me," the king of Dahomey said, "your country is conquered, and you are before me in chains. I shall take you to Abomey." "No!" the king of Takoi answered. "I am king in Takoi. I will not go to Dahomey." He knew that he would be killed for a spectacle in Dahomey. He chose to die at home. So 2 Dahomean warriors held each of his hands, and an Amazon struck off his head. Later, 2 representatives of a European power attended the customs of the king at Abomey, and tell of seeing the highly polished skull of the king of Takoi mounted in a beautiful ship model. His name and his nation were mentioned in the chant to the glory of Dahomey. The skull was treated with the utmost respect, as the king of Dahomey would expect his to be treated in case he fell in battle. That was the custom in West Africa. For the same reason, no one of royal blood was sold into slavery. They were killed. There are no descendants of royal African blood among American Negroes for that reason. The Negroes who claim that they are descendants of royal African blood have taken a leaf out of the book of the white ancestor hounds in America, whose folks went to England with William the Conqueror, got restless and caught the Mayflower for Boston, then feeling a romantic lack, rushed down the coast and descended from Pocahontas. From the number of her children, one is forced to the conclusion that that Pocahontas wasn't so pokey after all. Kosala told me of the march to Abomey after the fall of Tocoi, how they were yoked by forked sticks and tied in a chain, how the Dahomans halted the march the second day in order to smoke the heads of the victims because they were spoiling. The prisoners had to watch the heads of their friends and relatives turning on long poles in the smoke. Abomey and the palace of the king, and then the march to the coast and the barracoons. They were there some time before a ship came to trade. Many, many tribes were there, each in a separate barracoon, lest they war among themselves. The traders could choose which tribe they wanted. When the tribe was decided upon, he was carried into the barracoon where that tribe was confined. The women were lined up on one side, and the men on the other. He walked down between the lines and selected the individuals he wanted. They usually took an equal number. He described the embarkation and the trip across the ocean in the Clotilde, a fast-sailing vessel built by the Meyer brothers of Maine, who had moved to Alabama. They were chased by a British man-of-war on the lookout for slavers, but the Clotilde showed him her heels. Finally, the cargo arrived in Mobile. They were unloaded up the river, the boat sunk, and the 100-odd Africans began a 4-year life of slavery. "We're so surprised to see mule and plow. We're so surprised to see man pushy and mule pulley." After the war, these Africans made a settlement of their own at Plateau, Alabama, 3 miles up the river from Mobile. They farmed and worked in the lumber mills and bought property. The descendants are still there. Kosala's great sorrow in America was the death of his favorite son, David, killed by a train. He refused to believe it was his David when he saw the body. He refused to let the bell be tolled for him.
"If that my boy, where his head? No, that not my David, that not my boy. My boy gone to Mobile. No. No. Don't ring the bell for David. That not him."
But finally, his wife persuaded him that the headless body on the window blind was their son. He cried hard for several minutes and then said,
"Ring the bell."
His other great sorrow was that he had lost track of his folks in Africa.
"They don't know what become of Kosala. When you go there, you tell it where I at."
He begged me. He did not know that his tribe was no more upon this earth, except for those who reached the barracoon at Dmida. None of his family was in the barracoon. He had missed seeing their heads in the smoke, no doubt. It is easy to see how few would have looked on that sight too closely.
"I lonely for my folks. They don't know. Maybe they ask everybody go there where Kosala. I know they hunt for me."
There was a tragic catch in his voice, like the whimper of a lost dog. After 75 years, he still had that tragic sense of loss, that yearning for blood and cultural ties, that sense of mutilation. It gave me something to feel about. Of my research in the British West Indies and Haiti, my greatest thrill was coming face to face with a zombie and photographing her. This act had never happened before in the history of man. I mean, the taking of the picture. I have said all that I know on the subject in the book Tell My Horse, which has been published also in England under the title Voodoo Gods. I have spoken over the air on We the People on the subject, and the matter has been so publicized that I will not go into details here. But it was a tremendous thrill, though utterly macabre. I went kanzo in voodoo ceremonies in Haiti, and the ceremonies were both beautiful and terrifying. I did not find them any more invalid than any other religion, Rather, I hold that any religion that satisfies the individual urge is valid for that person. It does satisfy millions, so it is true for its believers. The sect Rouge, also known as the Cochon Gris, Gray Pig, and Ving Bradrig, from the sound of the small drum, a cannibalistic society there, has taken cover under the name of voodoo. But the two things are in no wise the same. What is more, if science ever gets to the bottom of voodoo in Haiti and Africa, it will be found that some important medical secrets, still unknown to medical science, give it its power, rather than the gestures of ceremony. Chapter 11. Books and Things. While I was in the research field in 1929, the idea of Jonas Gourdvine came to me. I had written a few short stories, but the idea of attempting a book seemed so big that I gazed at it in the quiet of the night, but hid it away from even myself in daylight. For one thing, it seemed off-key. What I wanted to tell was a story about a man, and from what I had read and heard, Negroes were supposed to write about the race problem. I was and am thoroughly sick of the subject. My interest lies in what makes a man or a woman do such and so, regardless of his color. It seemed to me that the human beings I met reacted pretty much the same to the same stimuli. Different idioms, yes. Circumstances and conditions having power to influence, yes. Inherent difference, no. But I said to myself that that was not what was expected of me, so I was afraid to tell a story the way I wanted, or rather, the way the story told itself to me. So I went on that way for 3 years. Something else held my attention for a while. As I told you before, I had been pitched head foremost into the Baptist church when I was born. I had heard the singing, the preaching, and the prayers. They were a part of me. But on the concert stage, I always heard songs called spirituals sung and applauded as Negro music, and I wondered what would happen if a white audience ever heard a real spiritual. To me, what the Negroes did in Macedonia Baptist Church was finer than anything that any trained composer had done to the folk songs. I had collected a mass of work songs, blues, and spirituals in the course of my years of research. After offering them to two Negro composers and having them refused on the ground that white audiences would not listen to anything but highly arranged spirituals, I decided to see if that was true. I doubted it because I had seen groups of white people in my father's church as early as I could remember. They had come to hear the singing. And certainly there was no distinguished composer in Zion Hope Baptist Church. The congregation just got hold of the tune and arranged as they went along as the Spirit moved them. And any musician, I don't care if he stayed at a conservatory until his teeth were gone and he smelled like old folks, could never even approach what those untrained singers could do. Let the people sing was and is my motto. And finally, I resolved to see what would happen. So on money I had borrowed, I put on a show at the John Golden Theater on January 10, 1932, and tried out my theory. The performance was well received by both the audience and the critics, because I know that music without motion is not natural with my people. I did not have the singer stand in a stiff group and reach for the high note. I told them to just imagine that they were in Macedonia and go ahead. One critic said that he did not believe that the concert was rehearsed. It looked so natural. I had dramatized a working day on a railroad camp, from the shack rouser waking up the camp at dawn until the primitive dance in the deep woods at night. While I did not lose any money, I did not make much, but I am satisfied that I proved my point. I have seen the effects of that concert in all the Negro singing groups since then. Primitive Negro dancing has been given tremendous impetus. work songs have taken on. In that performance, I introduced West Indian songs and dances, and they have come to take an important place in America. I am not upset by the fact that others have made something out of the things I pointed out. Rather, I am glad if I have called any beauty to the attention of those who can use it. In May 1932, the Depression did away with money for research, so far as I was concerned. So I took my nerve in my hand and decided to try to write the story I had been carrying around in me. Back in my native village, I wrote first Mules and Men. That is, I edited the huge mass of material I had, arranged it in some sequence, and laid it aside. It was published after my first novel. Mr. Robert Wunsch and Dr. John Rice were both on the faculty at Rollins College at Winter Park, which is 3 miles from Eatonville. Dr. Edwin Osgood Grover, Dr. Hamilton Holt, president of Rollins, together with Rice and Wunsch, were interested in me. I gave 3 folk concerts at the college under their urging. Then I wrote a short story, The Gilded 6 Bits, which Bob Wunsch read to his class in creative writing before he sent it off to Story Magazine. Thus I came to know Martha Foley and her husband, Whit Burnett, the editors of Story. They bought the story and it was published in the August issue, 1933. They never told me, but it is my belief that they did some missionary work among publishers in my behalf, because 4 publishers wrote me and asked if I had anything of book length. Mr. Bertram Lippincott of the J.B. Lippincott Company was among these. He wrote a gentle-like letter, and so I was not afraid of him. Exposing my efforts did not seem so rash to me after reading his letter. I wrote him and said that I was writing a book. Mind you, not the first word was on paper when I wrote him that letter. But the very next week, I moved up to Sanford, where I was not so much at home as at Eatonville, and could concentrate more, and sat down to write Jonah's Gourdvine. I rented a house with a bed and stove in it for $1.50 a week. I paid 2 weeks and then my money ran out. My cousin, Willie Lee Hurston, was working and making $3.50 per week, and she always gave me the 50 cents to buy groceries with. In about 3 months, I finished the book. The problem of getting it typed was then upon me. Municipal Judge S.A.B. Wilkinson asked his secretary, Mildred Knight, if she would not do it for me and wait on the money. I explained to her that the book might not even be taken by Lippincott. I had been working on a hope. She took the manuscript home with her and read it. Then she offered to type it for me. She said, "It is going to be accepted, all right. I'll type it. Even if the first publisher does not take it, somebody will." So between them, they bought the paper and carbon, and the book was typed. I took it down to the American Express office to mail it and found that it cost $1.83 to mail, and I did not have it. So I went to see Mrs. John Leonardi, a most capable woman lawyer and wife of the county prosecutor. She did not have the money at the moment, but she was the treasurer of the local Daughter Elks. She borrowed $2 from the treasury and gave it to me to mail my book. That was on October 3rd, 1933. On October 16th, I had an acceptance by wire. But it did not come so simply as that. I had been hired by the Seminole County Chamber of Commerce to entertain the business district of Sanford with my concert group for that day. I was very glad to get the work because my landlord was pressing me for the back rent. I now owed $18. I was to receive $25 for the day, so I saw my way clear to pay up my rent and have a little over. It was not to be that way, however. At 8 o'clock of October 16th, my landlord came and told me to get out. I told her that I could pay her that day, but she said she didn't believe that I would ever have that much money. No, she preferred the house. So I took my card table and my clothes up to my Uncle Isaiah's house and went off to entertain the city at 11 o'clock. The sound truck went up and down the streets, and my boys sang. That afternoon, while I was still on the sound truck, a Western Union messenger handed me a wire. Naturally, I did not open it there. We were through at 3 o'clock. The Chamber of Commerce not only paid us, we were all given an order which we could take to any store we wanted and get what we chose. I needed shoes, so I took mine to a shoe store. My heart was weighing as much as cordwood, and so I forgot the wire until I was having the shoes fitted. When I opened it and read that Jonas Gourdvine was accepted and that Lippincott was offering me $200 advance, I tore out of that place with one old shoe and one new one on and ran to the Western Union office. Lippincott had asked for an answer by wire, and they got it. Terms accepted. I never expect to have a greater thrill than that wire gave me. You know the feeling when you found your first pubic hair? Greater than that. When producer Arthur Hornblow took me to lunch at Lucy's and hired me at Paramount, it was nice, very nice. I was most elated. But I had had 5 books accepted then. Been a Guggenheim Fellow twice, spoken at 3 book fairs with all the literary greats of America and some from abroad, and so I was a little more used to things. So you see why Bertram Lippincott is Colonel Bert to me. When the Negroes in the South name a white man a colonel, it means class, something like a monarch, only bigger and better. And when the colored population in the South confer a title, the white people recognize it, because the Negroes are never wrong. They may flatter an ordinary boss man by calling him captain, but when they say colonel, general, and governor, they are recognizing something internal. It is there, and it is accepted, because it can be seen. I wrote Their Eyes Were Watching God in Haiti. It was dammed up in me, and I wrote it under internal pressure in 7 weeks. I wish that I could write it again. In fact, I regret all of my books. It is one of the tragedies of life that one cannot have all the wisdom one is ever to possess in the beginning. Perhaps it is just as well to be rash and foolish for a while. If writers were too wise, perhaps no books would get written at all. It might be better to ask yourself why afterwards than before. Anyway, the force from somewhere in space which commands you to write in the first place gives you no choice. You take up the pen when you are told and write what is commanded. There is no agony like bearing an untold story inside you. You have all heard of the Spartan youth with the fox under his cloak. Dust Tracks on a Road is being written in California, where I did not expect to be at this time. I did not come out here to California to write about the state. I did not come to get into the movies. I came because my good friend Catherine Edson Mershon invited me out here to rest and have a good time. However, I have written a book here and gone to work in the movies. This surprises me because I did not think that I would live long enough to do anything out here but die. Friend Catherine Mershon is a mountain goat while I am a lowland turtle. I want to rock along on level ground. She can't look at a mountain without leaping on it. I think she is ashamed if she ever catches both of her feet on the same level. She cries, "Excelsior!" in her sleep. Jack, her husband, told me that the reason he has that sort of smoothed-off look was because she dragged him up a mountain the next day after they got married, and he has never been able to get his right shape back again. Well, 1941 was a hard year for me, too. She showed me California. Before it was over, I felt like I had spent 2 months walking a cross-cut saw. The minute I get to be governor of California, I mean to get me an oversized plane and a spirit level and fix this state so it can be looked at without rearing back.
epic, nothing. Level. Level, California. And I do mean level.
Chapter 12. My people, my people. My people, my people. From the earliest rocking of my cradle days, I have heard this cry go up from Negro lips. It is forced outward by pity, scorn, and hopeless resignation.